Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left Shireen Gourbani. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hi to the listeners.
And on the political right, Senator Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hi, it's good to be back with everybody.
Dan, we missed you last week, but you were busy in the session, and here we are again. And I want to talk about the session, but before we do that, let's talk about the American Rescue Plan. This is what it looks like President Biden will sign into law this week. Brings a lot of money to the state of Utah and a lot of money to the country at large.
So, Natalie, I saw you this morning at a newsmaker's breakfast where there was a deep dive into the numbers. Would you share some of the highlights, especially as it pertains to Utah?
Happy to do that. The way I would kind of set it up is just to say this is unprecedented stimulus money. And you have to take it in the context of since this pandemic started in March of 2020. There was the Families First Act. There was the CARES Act. There was Paycheck Protection and Healthcare Enhancement. Then what President Trump signed into law in December, the Response and Relief, and now the American Rescue Plan. It's $5.2 trillion or 25%, approaching 25% of GDP. That's just a stunningly large amount. I can see Dan's reacting with his eyes. Dan and Shireen, when I worked more closely with the state budget, this is during the Great Recession when we had the ARRA funds, the American Recovery Act. That was $800 billion and about 5% of GDP. So we're talking five times the magnitude of the Great Recession.
Yeah.
Dan, let's get you into the conversation there, and just I can give you some Utah numbers, but just the wow factor of what we're talking about there.
You know, it's really kind of interesting to look at what Washington can agree on and what it can't agree on, right? What Washington can agree on is spending money is good, and giving money to people is good, and and getting back to work and those kinds of things. Maybe good, right? And that's one of the interesting components of what the plan is. It's like, I don't know. In some ways, this last legislative session, it felt like we were drowning in money. I know that sounds ridiculous, but we were drowning in money, right? With a $1.5 billion surplus. And, if we were drowning before, with gold bars falling from heaven, from the federal government, it will be interesting to see how Utah allocates this new money. And honestly, it's going to be a very entertaining, I'll say to the least, to try and solve some of the problems, this good problems, I guess, it may create.
Yeah. Shireen, this American Rescue Plan, about $1.9 trillion at the U.S. level, but to our state government should get about $1.7 billion of that. Local government, about another billion. And then you've got the $1,400 per person in stimulus checks. That's another $3.8 billion to our state. And then the expanded child tax credit, another $1.2 billion. I'm just telling you, this is billions of dollars coming to the state of Utah at a time when it looks like our economy is about ready to launch.
Yeah. So Dan had used the word ridiculous. I think there are some things that are, I wouldn't necessarily say ridiculous, but concerning. We know that there are small businesses that are just on the ropes and need a little help here in these last few months as we see the economy come back to life. I hope that's a priority that we see addressed quickly. I think there are some really incredible things going on here. And I know, Dan, you've said numerous times that you, love children and want to see programs that support kids. This has the opportunity to cut child poverty in our country in half. And I think that is a monumental achievement when we think about the impact that that can have in the trajectory of a child's life and what that does for families here in this state and across this country. I'm incredibly proud of it. I also think it's important that, when we're talking about this, we're really talking about the way that those investments coming into our state are the reason that we really were able to see some big investments from our state in terms of infrastructure and thinking about really strategic long-term planning. We were in a good position with this additional support. I think there's just the opportunity to see some really crucial projects come to life.
Dan, am I correct that we didn't have anyone in the Utah congressional delegation support this?
Yeah, there was absolutely not a single Republican vote to support any of it, right?
At the same time, 75% of Americans
supported it. That's an interesting bipartisan move.
Yeah. You know, I've struggled to think what I would have done, you know, if I had this vote, because I do think it's excessive, but there were parts of it that I think were really helpful and needed. I note that a family of four would get $5,600, you know, a lower income family. They would also get rental assistance, child care assistance. Schools would open, you know, in parts of the country where they're not, and they get help with the vaccine distributions. I mean, this is a full force march. Make no mistake about it, to try and get us out of this pandemic. Dan Schreiner, either of you been vaccinated? I can't remember where you stand.
I've gotten the first, so I'm a volunteer for the mass vaccination sites and was able to get my first dose of Pfizer on last Saturday.
Oh, interesting. And Dan, how about you?
Nope, no vaccine for me. No. I'm still outside of the target audience, and you know, we'll see if I decide to get it when it's time.
So
I'm excited, honestly.
So I accompanied my husband today to a mass vaccination site, the D Event Center up in Ogden. Made the drive up there. I wasn't vaccinated myself, but I just watched this, and boy, it was a beautiful thing.
It's incredible.
All these people from all different backgrounds descending upon a large area with volunteers and just the throughput of people getting vaccinated. It was emotional to me.
So. It's been for me too. And I have to say, there's this incredible sense. I was so proud when the call came from the governor and, you know, hundreds of people across our state signed up, and just to see the, you know, people greeting people into, I've been mostly down in Sandy at the Expo Center. I'm going to be at the Salt Palace this week, but the experience that it is to stand there with those volunteers and to see, in my case, a lot of familiar faces of individuals from the county who have, again, stepped into this incredibly crucial role in our community. I could not be more proud of how our community has stepped up, and especially how a lot of our county employees have responded.
Yeah. Dan, I don't know if you want to say anything there. If not, I want to transition to some of this, what people are characterizing as voter suppression occurring in our country. And I don't know a lot about this topic. I mean, I know that Georgia is considered ground zero for this. It is the state that has been the focus of so much during these election years. But the state Senate's approved legislation that would end the right of voters to cast absentee ballots without excuses while toughening up some voter ID requirements. Dan, I'm going to characterize you as a political scientist. I know you're trained in other things, but you certainly understand politics a lot. What do you make of what is at least being alleged here?
I also stayed at a Holiday Inn Express, which really has made me an expert on just about everything. So, you know, I really don't understand. There are some things I don't understand on the left, and there are some things I don't understand on the right. So if I was just to talk candidly about the voter stuff, I don't understand the, you know, some of the stuff that's done to obviously kind of game the component of like taking down the number of voters, like decreasing absentee ballots. Like that just seems lame, right? But I also don't understand on the left, like, okay, I get it. There are some people who are poor and as a result of poverty are unlikely to have an identification. I get that. That said, people that want to vote, we have got to be able to provide some kind of measure that the person is who they say they are, so that the folks on the right feel like they have a secure election. And for some reason, the left cannot see that, and the right cannot see the idea that this creating hurdles to vote, as far as the absentee process, that isn't, you know, they can't see the destructive nature of that. So I'd say they're both probably wrong, but the fact that neither one of them can like see their weaknesses really is quite destructive to the whole process, because it leaves the right questioning outcomes like we saw in this last election, and it leaves the left pointing fingers and screaming about suppression and those kinds of things. Neither one of them is productive. So here we are.
You know, Dan, I get what you're saying on the ID requirements. What about on the, you know, different things we're seeing across the country where they close down the polls an hour earlier or they don't allow voting on Sunday? That part seems pretty suspect to me.
Maybe, but you realize a lot of those locations that don't allow voting on Sunday also don't allow, you know, shopping on Sunday. Like a lot of their stores are closed. They have Sunday blue laws in a lot of places. Not all of them, but there are some.
It's
And I don't know. And there's also a component of, you know, poll workers may want a day off sometime during the week. I don't know why they can't like schedule throughout and have different people day offs. Like that kind of stuff is screwy to me. But what you see is like this effort to try and change an outcome is actually done on both sides, right? And I think both sides claiming that they're innocent of trying to change the outcomes is really, that part is humorous.
Okay, so
Shireen,
first of all,
we'll give you the last word.
I just absolutely have, I would love to hear Dan talk about a clear example of what he means there. But these changes in Georgia are particularly concerning for many people. We know that Souls to the Polls is a huge program that gets Black voters out. That happens on Sundays, you know, after church services. This is a targeted effort to make it harder for Black individuals in Georgia to vote. But the thing that's, I think, a bigger picture there in terms of why I think everyone should care, we should all care about voter suppression. But many of the individuals who vote absentee or vote by mail are older individuals, and they're predominantly white. So this is something that disproportionately impacts communities of color, but everyone loses when we make it harder for people to vote.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. We've been talking about a lot of things in Washington. In our next segment, we're going to talk about the 2021 legislative session and how it ended up. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I want to talk about this, the 2021 legislative session, but one of the things that really popped for us is this mask mandate being lifted on April 10th. And Dan, you've got to have some good behind the scenes kind of commentary on that. What was it about April 10th? Did you support this? What was the reasoning behind it? And then we'll let the left comment.
Well, we've seen the numbers, you know, keep moving down, and we see a lot of, you know, concerns from constituents about the mask mandate and the frustrations about, you know, the mask mandate. Just realize that the bill does have like some benchmarks that have to still be met. So it's not like, you know, it's just a foregone conclusion. But that said, the data from the health department showed that it would, you know, going beyond April 10th was like an extra measure of caution because of the number of people that were going to be vaccinated by that point and the amount of people that you would be remaining unvaccinated at that point. And you look at the infection rates and all of those things combined, that actually rolling this thing beyond April 10th was kind of a, you know, an overabundance of caution, one. And two, the other part of it too, that was, you know, that was weighing on everybody's mind is there are a lot of people who are absolutely sick of wearing a mask. Do you know what I mean? And there is a real frustration, and in some ways they've been unwilling participants in the whole mask conversation, but they've done it, right? And I think there was a real sense that they, you know, that we should not drag this thing longer than is actually needed. And that was really where kind of the mixture of the two data. And I love Jenny Wilson. Think she's great. She's just wrong on this one issue, right? And obviously you can. This is the whole argument about the pandemic anyway. And this is just a proxy. Therefore, you got to make calculated risks in life. Everywhere you go, it's all calculated risks. And we have set up an amazing support system so that those who still need a distance can distance. And we also have the ability for those who need a vaccine, especially by the 1st of April, will have access to it. I mean, by that point, we'll be dropped down to the FDA and the CDC recommendation of who can actually get a vaccine at that point. And it will be available to everyone that it is available to. So then carrying on the mask mandate really is just kind of insult to injury.
Shireen, love to hear your commentary. I would love to see people continue to wear masks until we have a higher level of vaccination, whether it's mandated or not. I'm not really, that's neither here nor there to me. I just would like to see it.
Yeah, I think about when business owners are coming forward and talking about the difficult experiences that they had trying to get people to wear masks. I think that when we are talking about, you know, moving to, we've already moved to increased capacity in our restaurants and bars without a concerted effort to get a lot of those workers vaccinated quickly, especially individuals who often work in restaurants and bars are uninsured. Some of the decisions that are being made there don't make a lot of sense to me, and I would have liked to see a more strategic approach to that. Especially one where we know these businesses really do want to see the, you know, business come back into their establishments. They want to, you know, get back on top of, you know, bringing back their staff, you know, meeting payroll, all of the things that are stressing our small businesses here. I would love to see it maybe at the end of April, when we know that more people in that category have been able to get at least that first vaccine and could have more protection. And I think it's really, you know, I mean, to say it's insult to injury, I really think about it as just like a deeply caring, patriotic thing that you can do for your fellow Utahns. And I hope that others continue to think about it that way, too.
I did think it was nice to see that our state is nearing 80% first dose vaccination rate for people who are 70 or older. 80%, and then the 90% range for residents of long-term care facilities. So that is a huge hurdle that we've come through.
Huge.
Let's talk about the legislative session. And the way I'm kind of thinking about this, it was like a $23.5 billion budget, had $1.5 billion in new money, something like 1,200 plus bills requested. They numbered over 700 bills, passed just over 500 bills. Wow. And Dan and Shireen, as a observer of the session, this session had a little bit of everything without a lot of controversy. We paid for infrastructure. We, you know, spent a lot of money on education. We did some nice police reforms. There was a lot going on. And Dan, I think you and your colleagues have probably feel like you did a really good job.
Well, I think walking away from it, you know, usually after the session, you know, it's usually there's a day, right, of like serious news day of like Friday. And then you've got Saturday when actually like other news kind of stuff that passed on the last night kind of hits everybody and they kind of filter through it. And then there's an oops, I can't believe we let that through. Right. That happens almost every year I've been in the legislature. And this year we don't have it, though. To your point, and that's actually kind of an interesting, it's kind of an interesting component that the fight itself, you know, and we had some fights, you know, in the chamber, chambers and in the hallways about a few, you know, items, but for the most part, things just worked out and there isn't a terribly embarrassing bill this year. And that, I call that a huge success.
You see it the same way, Shireen. And, you know, if you were giving them a grade, what grade would you give the legislature this year?
Oh, good question. You know, I used to teach, so I'm excited about this exercise. So a few things. I would say one of the biggest disappointments that I saw was that the opportunity to cover all of our children in Utah got so close, and in the end, it simply just did not get funded. That's something that I hope is reconsidered as quickly as possible. There's, again, just a big opportunity to really change the trajectory of children's lives here in the state, and I would love to see that be a priority that actually does get funding. So I moved here about 11 years ago. I think this might be my 12th year. I really struggle during the legislative session, and I love this state dearly. And every morning when I would get up and kind of read through the news would feel, you know, a level of frustration and in some cases embarrassment. There were definitely a few bills that raised major red flags for me that I was very concerned about. And I was happy to see those bills did not move forward this year. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, you know, it wasn't as gut-wrenching as some previous ones have been for me and the kinds of, you know, things that I would like to see move forward. And a lot of really good things that I do care about did get funded when we think about investments in education and infrastructure, yeah. Right? The affordable housing dollars are huge, and that's an incredible accomplishment. So a lot of really good things did happen. I think there is still some stuff being, you know, sorted out. I'm still catching up on some of the pieces of it. But I'm going to give it a B.
Okay, give it a B. Let's go through a couple of the details. So on policing reforms, I don't have all the bill numbers in my head here, but, you know, there was a bill to require more training on how to deal with people going through a mental health crisis who have developmental disabilities. another bill that when a police officer points a weapon at someone, that they were required to file a report. And then police will soon be banned from shooting at people who are suicidal, the suicide by cop. These are some pretty important adjustments, Dan.
Yeah, and, you know, in some ways, it probably didn't go as far as, you know, like Shireen would probably give it A if we got all of those things, plus like some of the other stuff that was included, right, in some of the earlier versions of the bills. But I think, you know, these are good measured responses. But again, from a justice reform standpoint, we really have to think twice about, at some point, we're going to stop like pointing our fingers at the patrolmen and women who are out there in their cars and on the streets and doing their job, and be focused more on, you know, how are we setting up law enforcement and enforcing laws in ways that are causing unintended consequences. And unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of progress in that area, right? And so if I was going to say, there's something I'd love to see done a little bit differently, and maybe at some point we'll stop pointing our fingers at those who probably don't deserve it.
I think this is actually kind of linking back to the earlier conversation about, you know, the amount of dollars that we've seen in response to COVID in this country. One of the interesting takeaways from the conversation at the Newsmakers event this morning was that we've had to do a lot more than other countries because we simply don't have the same kind of welfare systems or places where we catch people when they are lacking access to healthcare or falling through the cracks when it comes to issues like mental health. There's so much that we could be doing in that space so that we don't get to these really critical situations that far too often, I guess I would say, go really sideways and people lose their lives. There's so much that can be done in that space to really improve our mental health response.
I attended a news conference this session at the state capitol, and it dealt with the $50 million that was appropriated towards homelessness and affordable housing programs. This is money for the Olene Walker Housing Trust Fund for housing preservation, money for a new homeless services officer where the state takes on a more of a role for this important crisis in our state. So I think it was a big year for housing and homelessness, Shireen.
I agree. That is really one of the pieces that, you know, I think I normally would have landed at maybe a C or something lower, but those investments are commendable. It's a huge accomplishment.
Well, and if you look at the private matching in the affordable housing component, I mean, you're well over $700 million as an investment. I mean, that's a pretty substantial step towards greater socialism, and I think that would make you happy.
And does it make you happy?
Mixed.
Oh, you don't like the investments in affordable housing.
No,
got it.
It's not so much that. It's just that I always get worried when the government meddles in housing and tries to make it affordable, right? When the government really is part of the problem. We outzone and we push people further and further away to have, quote, affordability. But that's a whole other issue.
Hey, but Dan, I'd love to ask you just what stands out for you this session? I mean, there was all this money for infrastructure, about $1.2 billion in funding and bonding, the double tracking of Front Runner, streetcar for Salt Lake City. Those were just the notes I jotted down on infrastructure. What in your world was the big one?
Well, and the other part of the infrastructure that wasn't talked about, that isn't well publicized, is the idea that, you know, we've also started to invest in our canyons, right? So, you know, we took and we put a $20 million investment into the canyon this year, and we'll see that money actually grow over the next few years. And really the primary goal and objective, at least, you know, from all accounts, is to try and figure out a way to get cars really out of the both Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. And if you think about from just a tourist standpoint alone, you know, the predictability that people can come and enjoy Utah slopes, this is really going to help open up the state, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Huge quality of life issue. Huge.
And that's probably that's the best part of the message, is that we did make some significant gains with the money that we had, with good investments that actually can like improve the quality of life of the people living here in the Utah.
Shireen, I just want to ask Dan this one, and you might want to comment as well. But Dan, tell our listeners about the regulatory sandbox. This is the Regulatory Relief Office in the Office of Economic Development or Economic Opportunity. What's the quick take on what is that?
Well, it's great, right? Like, we all know that regulation has a cost from a business standpoint. And if there was a way to study and advise the government on its costs to its business, and how to inform everybody of how those costs work, you'd do it in a sandbox where you find out the effects of these regulations and, you know, whether or not they're ready for prime time or not. And the regulatory sandbox is a great way to kind of look at some of these things, study more. And it's really the first in the nation that's been able to do it. I think it's going to be really cool.
Interesting. Shireen, we got to wrap up the program. I want to give you just the last word on the legislative session, what you saw from the left and what our listeners should get excited about.
So what I hope our listeners are excited about, what I hope everyone's paying attention to, is that we are heading into redistricting. So these districts are going to look different. People are going to be, I hope, paying close attention to what happens. And frankly, if we see partisan gerrymandering or if we see a fair bout.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center with Dan McKay on the right, Shireen Gourbani on the left. Program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.